Good evening. Does everybody have an intact house tonight? Nobody blew away? Good.
So how are you?
I'm intact too. My bird feeder was clamped to the railing of the deck. There was a long metal pole with a clamp, so it was on so tight I couldn't get it off anymore. So the wind just broke the railing and flung the whole thing all the way down the yard. That's how hard it was blowing up there. It's amazing. So we have begun Heart Sutra. We had an introduction last time, and not all of you were here for it, so let me do the handout for that. Oh, that's very helpful. So, those are the extras from the first one. Oh, thank you. And then these are the second one. It's just one page. So this is pretty simple. Sort of basic definitions, the first few pages. To get us started, the interesting thing to me always is that Prajnaparamita Ridaya Sutra means great sutra of the perfection of wisdom that reaches the other shore, you could say. That's what paramita means, or helps us to reach the other shore, to make this passage that our way-seeking mind keeps us feeling like we're going somewhere. But the very first word is Avalokiteshvara. The first sound is Ah, the heart sound, the most basic sound, Ah. And Avalokiteshvara is the embodiment of compassion. So, although this is a sutra about wisdom, it's being expressed by compassion. Because to be true and authentic, wisdom and compassion are two aspects of the same thing. There is always wisdom in compassion, and always compassion in wisdom. As we express the truth. I brought some illustrations. Here's some some Avalokiteshvaras for you all to enjoy. As you know, there are many, many, many different images of Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, Tara. I always hope that we'll make our own images of it, our own kind of American style of Avalokiteshvara. Be interesting to see what that would be. Now, I think Donna Lynn has actually done that already. More than once. Avalokiteshvara is hearer of the cries of the world, as I said last week, and hears any cry for help. I've told this story before, some of you know it, but when I lived in Mountain View, my hair was being cut by a Vietnamese family in Palo Alto, a family of seven young people who had escaped from Vietnam as boat people and survived, all seven of them and their parents. Amy, who was the one who told me the story, was the oldest. She and her father went first in a boat and were attacked first by an enormous storm. And after they survived that, pirates attacked them and killed many people in the boat. But somehow she escaped, she and her father both. She said she prayed to Avalokiteshvara, cried out for help. And she felt at the time that that's why she survived. But then they all moved to Palo Alto. Her father was a dentist, and he went to work to try to become a dentist again. And all the kids went to beauty school and learned how to cut hair and set up their own little shop. But they had a terrible time. People took advantage of their being strangers, not knowing the customs, not hardly knowing the language, and robbed them and cheated them in every kind of way. And she got more and more depressed and felt like they'd made a mistake even to come here. And one day, her next-door neighbor, whom she didn't even know, called her over and said, I've got this thing that somebody gave me. It's a statue, and I don't really know anything about it. But since you're from Asia, it seems like maybe you would like to have it. And it was the statue of Avalokiteshvara. And she was amazed, and she said, well, yes, she guessed so. She really wasn't into that kind of thing right then. She was trying to keep her bank balance. But she took it home, and she found herself sitting and sort of keeping company with Avalokiteshvara. And she said everything turned around. Everything got better after that. She said, I don't tell most people about this because they would think that was superstitious. She said, I think that's what happened. Avalokiteshvara came back to me. Coben says, maybe Avalokiteshvara appears with the voice of a bird or beach sounds. It can appear in many forms. A piece of bread, that is Avalokiteshvara too. It's a way of remembering with gratitude how supported we are. From beginning to end, we are completely supported. In spite of how alone we feel, in spite of how alone we are utterly supported. So it's Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, and as we know, Bodhisattva is awakening being. Or a being who has vowed to practice until everyone is awakened, or to awaken quickly to help other people. It's another way of talking about compassion and wisdom. So, Red Pine quotes somebody as saying, an old Chinese teacher as saying, beings have never ceased to be bodhisattvas. Beings meaning we. We have never ceased to be bodhisattvas. But because we don't understand that individuals and dharmas are empty, and we become trapped by suffering, we call us beings. Once a person's understanding is unobstructive, who isn't a bodhisattva? So Avalokiteshvara is practicing meditation, practicing deep, deep meditation, practicing the paramita of wisdom, prajna. And there, we can talk about wisdom, we can talk about prajna. My favorite way of talking about prajna as the opposite of vijna, which is consciousness. With consciousness, we separate our knowledge and name things as different. We emphasize the differences so that this paper is not the same as this watch. And this foot is not the same as this foot. We can call each little thing that we notice, that we are aware of, by a name and separate it out from all the rest. That's what our mind is so good at doing. We're brilliant at doing. It makes our life so rich. The other side of the Vijna mind is the wholeness, the oneness of us, so that although this foot is different from this foot, they are part of the same body. And although this paper isn't nearly the same as this watch, they're in the same world together, in the same universe together, are wedded inextricably. We are all wedded inextricably. And when we practice prajnaparamita, we begin to understand not only that we are a separate self, but that there is, you could say, a greater self of which we are a part. And getting a handle on that separate self and the greater self is what the practice of the five skandhas is about. The five skandhas are, as we chant every time, form, feeling, perception, impulses, and consciousness. So there are ways, different ways of analyzing what it is to be a human and how it is that we understand every single thing that we see and know. We can't see and know anything without passing it through our perceptions and having a judgment about it and having thoughts about it based on thoughts and experiences that we've had before. So you begin to see how we're a kind of flowing river of insight and impulse and experience and repeated experiences that go on and on and on like a river, or like many rivers. And for every moment of those, we say, this is me. But if we look carefully, we can't find me in any of those. So the encouragement is to learn to practice with the five skandhas, to really look deeply into how we know ourself and how we know other, anything other. How in our form and others' forms do we know what we know? It's a very humbling practice. In some spiritual traditions, the whole practice of meditation is just asking, who am I? Or what is this? So that's what Avalokiteshvara was doing, practicing the five skandhas. And I want to talk about them more next week. But in the meantime, I wanted to talk a little bit about Shariputra, because that's the next character in this. Avalokiteshvara is practicing and has an insight and wants right away to tell Shariputra. So my electricity went out before I could type it up. So I'm going to tell you out of Red Pine, because he tells the story so nicely. He says that Shariputra was expected to be a Brahmin like his father, very high caste, very important religious figure. But he and his buddy, Madgalyayana, who were part of the same family, really, and spent all their time together, decided that they would give up everything and try to seek the truth, going off with way-seeking mind. And they studied with a teacher, wearing rags and bare feet and humbling themselves, but still looking. And finally they separated from each other and they said, well, if you find a real teacher, then let me know and I'll do the same. And so Shariputra was revisiting his old teacher, and on the way there he ran into one of Buddha's first disciples, one of the four that he met with after his enlightenment. And that man said, of what arises from causes, the Buddha shows how it begins and also how it ceases. Thus does the great recluse instruct. Of what arises from causes, the Buddha shows how it begins and also how it ceases. the arising of everything and the ceasing of everything, the utter impermanence of all things, coming and going, and Shariputra got it. He was struck by it, and went to tell Moggallayana, and they both went to see Buddha. And Buddha said, "Oh, I've been waiting for you. You are going to be my two best students, my two best disciples." Instant recognition. And he ordained them right away. And then Moggallayana was the very first as far as spiritual powers was concerned, and Shariputra was first in terms of wisdom. Shariputra always stands on Buddha's right and Moggallayana on Buddha's left. And Shariputra was also Buddha's chief assistant and sometimes preached the Dharma instead of Buddha. He died before Buddha, a few months before. And when I was in India, I drove around with a driver drove me around India, around all the Buddha places, and we went to the birthplace and the death place and the this place and that place and the enlightenment place. And as we were driving from one place to another, suddenly he pointed out the window and he said, "Shariputra's buried over there." And then we drove on. I was so, somehow that was more touching than seeing where Buddha had died. It was just so matter of fact that after all these thousands of years that we still know where Shariputra is buried. Remember. So Shariputra was a perfect student of this. He was the one who created the new Abhidharma, the Mahayana Abhidharma, the psychology, Buddhist psychology. And the Heart Sutra is really a sort of disabusing us of the old psychology, of the sort of simplistic one, that there are some dharmas that are real and some dharmas that are not real, and we can eradicate all the bad stuff in us and turn into perfect beings. That was the old sort of dispensation, you could say. And this new view was the Mahayana vision, you could say, was that it's bigger than that. I think that we tend as human beings to get a glimpse of how big and then revert to smallness. Of course, that's how we live and work with our life as beings. And yet, if we get stuck in the small size of us, we lose perspective very quickly and get very stuck without the sense of how big it is. And of all things, I think the Heart Sutra is pointing over and over to such bigness. It's why it seems so negative. There's no form, no feeling, no five skandhas, no eyes or ears or nose or tongue, no teachings of Buddha. What happens if there's no? Those are all ideas. And if we let them go, it's not that nothing is there, it's that everything is there. We're freed from this narrow little idea about things. And given, we give ourselves the whole. So are there questions? Tanya?
So do things really have timing, or do they just happen, like the lady that cut your hair, and she was given the gift, and all of a sudden, since then, things turned around? Or do they just happen at their own time? I mean, I know that there is, benefits of sitting. But it seems things just happen anyway.
Mm-hmm. That's what Buddha was saying. That's what struck Shariputra. That the causes and conditions are continual.
I mean, good things are happening all the time.
Yes, exactly.
And is it because one is sitting, all of a sudden things turned around for her? Or?
We don't know. We really don't know. But for her, the truth of it was that she turned around. She was unable to turn around because her neighbor, the cause of her turning was the neighbor, and it reminded her of something in the past, so that the support that she had, she was recognizing the support that was available to her, not in the statue, but in life, in her life.
That reminds me of the Christian stories that my parents are always talking about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and we prayed, and we prayed, and the Lord
was
a miracle.
Yes.
And it's so real.
Yes.
And, you know, the car was sliding, it went down the gully, and everybody was alive.
Mm-hmm.
Hallelujah, you know?
Yes. Yes.
Well, there's the Abhidharma psychology, and you know, one thing I don't necessarily believe in everything literally myself, but I did belong to a group that was associated with Shasta Abbey for a number of years, and every night we would chant the Kanza, which is a very beautiful sutra, with a lot of imagery about Kanza.
Yes, out of the Lotus Sutra. Yeah.
He has pulls the wheel within his hand.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I found after doing this for a couple of years, sometimes I would get some type of understanding. You know, at the most happen chance or unpredictable moment. You know, so this is what we call in our some branches of Western psychology, an archetypal figure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And all of these different statues of manifestations and imagery are, you know, they tend to be universal in some sense. I think that there's some similarity with the Christian iconography with Jesus, you know.
Yes.
Supposedly the divine son, filled with this
mm-hmm.
Or love, Christian love,
mm-hmm.
And so on that level, it works for
yes.
people.
Yes.
But I mean, I can't say it's absolutely true in any totally objective way.
Well, there isn't any objective way. That's the thing.
It has a role and some power in some life, you know.
Indeed. Indeed.
So when I see a story like this, you know, I can relate to it because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I've had some very small experience of it.
Have you seen Dan Layton's book about, is that on the book list?
Well,
If it's not, it should be.
I went to a seminar with Dan at Asahara back in July on Bodhisattva Architect.
Ah, there you are. He's written a whole book about it.
Right here.
Yes.
That's my cheat sheet. But you know, it made me think, it was very interesting because, you know,
Martin Luther King, Sister Teresa.
The discussions were really good for people from, you know, different backgrounds.
Yeah.
Just seeing how there's these different bodhisattvas, not just about the Kupaswara, but the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
And how they played out, you know, over the centuries.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
But anyway, that's just funny.
Thank you.
2 cents.
Descent.
But you were actually going to talk about the chanting itself, or the sounds. I mean, that's one, the archetypes, but then also the sounds. And some say that the original sound of the chants were chanted in a language that has, well, many of them have been forgotten, but, you know, again, resonate, like Angie was saying, the awe, you know, the resonates with the heart chakra, and, you know, there's a lot of interesting things, you know, also the power of chanting and the voice and the sounds. Yes, I think, you know, some people argue that that's what we should be doing, the sutras and the, you know, the Japanese or the
Yeah, or Pali.
Yeah. So, but it's very, very interesting. It's, you know, it's back to full prayer again. Maybe in a little while. It's just a very, very, very interesting story.
I think Aum is supposed to Aum. It's supposed to be a combination of these three sounds, sacred sounds that have this, are supposed to have mantric effects.
Power. Julian?
What I find interesting is about the, I guess, hearing the cries of the world. I was thinking of Mother Teresa, imagining where all the suffering that she was seeing, but I don't have an exact quote, but if I remember correctly, she talked about the experience of, not so much being sustained, actually, by the people she was there to help.
Mm-hmm.
And what, like, I think there's like a false wall between those we think we are helping and
yeah.
And the fact is, there's this mutual sustaining that's going on. Like, I've heard stories of a mother believing that her child had helped her through very difficult times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much of, like, I don't know, I mean, I'm kind of thinking about that. I mean, yeah, this whole, like, you know, burden, this duty, all that kind of stuff. But there's also, I mean, with a child, for example, there's something about a child that's very inspiring too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this,
it can happen anywhere, from anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Piece of bread. Well, it's 8 o'clock.